passion, drive, and patience. What brings home the winning trophy is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. From superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED lights, and more, whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to turn your car into the MVP and bring home that win. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Post Daily News Show for Friday, May the 6th. I am John Pollock. Waiting off today, but we have a more than suitable replacement. Lots of stuff to check out on the site before we get into all the WWE earnings fun. If you missed it, MCU later from Thursday night for Post Wrestling Cafe members, a cavalcade of stars. Waiting, WH Park, Rich Fan from the Pro Wrestling Torch site, and Nate Milton all getting together to chat the season finale of Moon Knight. And then coming up this weekend, we will let everyone know we will be live here on the channel right after UFC 274. Right after WrestleMania Backlash. There is a lot going on this weekend, including the Miami Grand Prix on Sunday afternoon as well. So a very, very busy weekend, but never too busy for this man who is joining us. It is our quarterly earnings chat with Brandon Thurston here at Post Wrestling. You can catch WrestleNomics every Sunday here on the site. And another record-breaking quarter, Brandon, and we can get right into things. Posting revenue of $33.4 million and net income of just over $66 million. Kind of staggering figures that we're just used to, Brandon, but to put into perspective, like the peak of the Attitude Era, like 99, 2000, like you're almost at this level that they're doing in one quarter of what the business was at the peak of many people's lifetime for WWF business. And that's what we're talking about for a quarter now.
Yeah. No Formula One talk, by the way.
It did not come up. I thought it was so close when he was just there on the Netflix. I thought with Drive to Survive getting renewed, I was like, okay.
I think he's talked about it in the past, though.
Yes. So,
but yeah, if you compare it to the Attitude Era, which, you know, everyone thinks of, rightly so, as the most popular era in this company's history, this is a much more profitable time today than then, even though it's considerably less popular today. And that's even adjusted for inflation, but that's just the nature of this very different business that we're seeing today that is so driven by media, by TV rights, by streaming rights even, and not so much by ticket sales.
If you do want to get in any of your super chats for Brandon, we will be taking those towards the end of the show, getting into all of the discussion points coming out of the earnings call. When it came to the estimates on Wall Street and your own estimates, Brandon, how did this quarter fare in terms of what they delivered?
I estimated an 81 cent EPS, which a lot of people probably don't know what that means. It's just an impression of profit, basically. And it ended up being, I believe, was it 78? No, not 78. 76 cents. 77. Yeah, I had some issues with the math. It didn't quite divide correctly for me in actually what they reported. Some accountant's going to have to explain this to me, why it was 76 cents. When you divide the diluted shares by the net income, it comes out to like 2 cents lower. But anyway, a little bit more accurate than the consensus of analysts. I was looking at the two reports that I do have access to and comparing their estimates to my estimates. Mine are a little bit more accurate. So yeah, it was, in terms of profitability, the various profitability metrics and in terms of revenue, it's, about what I expected. It was over what they guided. So they told investors in the previous quarterly earnings call that it would be within a certain range of adjusted EBITDA. I forget what it was. I think 80 to 90 or 90 to 100, something like that. They well exceeded that, reported, I believe, something like $111 million of adjusted EBITDA, mm-hmm. which is their profit metric where they're excluding certain things that they decide to exclude. But they did better than they expected. They did not raise their guidance for the full year. So I'm expecting there's going to be some more expenses, and just doing some quick math last night, they spent something. So I always, so here's, everybody's going to know the secret now, how I do these estimates. I take the operating expense on their media division, and then I divide that by the number of media events, so the TV events that they do in the quarter. And it came out to $5 million per media event. And that's really high relative to what it's been in the trailing, you know, several years. It's been like $3-4 million. And it's higher if there's a Saudi event, if there's a WrestleMania. Now, in this quarter, Q1, there was a Royal Rumble. There was a Saudi event. I think it's going to be considerably higher this year just because they are doing these stadium events.
Shows. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's going to be part of it. But yeah, I mean, financially, they're doing as well as they expected to.
In terms of just, you know, so much is focused on, you know, the escalation of the television rights, which it was a modest it was like 1% increase up this quarter. But, you know, this is a return to live events. It's not the robust schedule of years past, but nonetheless, live events is a sector on the ascent, as well as we have seen with consumer products. How did those kind of measure up to what you were looking at, and what that says just about kind of the state of the company now that they are back on the road on a more consistent basis than obviously a year ago?
So live events are profitable. That was a real struggle for them before the pandemic, where unless it was a WrestleMania quarter, they were either barely profitable or they had several quarters where they weren't profitable. But I had been estimating Q4, the first full quarter with the return to touring. Now, about 2 months? So they returned to touring in July. So that July, August, September would have been Q3. Q4 was a full quarter of return to touring. I figured they wouldn't be profitable, but they were profitable in the live events division. They were profitable again this quarter. And I was thinking about it. I wonder how much of that has to do with the lack of NXT doing any touring. And maybe that would partly explain why, you know, we haven't even seen the Largo Loop return.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that's a big part of that story in terms of why that event, why that division wasn't profitable pre-pandemic and is profitable now.
Yeah, and I know this is a point you've brought up when we've discussed kind of just the concept of house shows for this company is that, you know, with the reduced schedule, we are eliminating all of those kind of C-level cities that are not going to get a TV. And, you know, you're going to be more selective now in the markets that you do tour for live events. So you're not going to have kind of those smaller drawing cities on top of it.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that a lot. I'm kind of aware that that's an issue. But like, are they running fewer events now than they were in comparable quarters, like say Q1 2019? Did they run fewer events in this year than last year? It's now so long in the past, it's not even showing up on the KPIs now, right? Because we've got 2020 is probably the last year on the KPIs. But yeah, there's a value in doing house shows, even if they're not making money. And maybe they are. If NXT was such a big part of it, if it was, then maybe house shows are kind of profitable, and it is a marketing tool to go to a city and to, you know, promote the product in a town and get people to go to a show and have memories, and then they'll engage with the product again later.
Of course, the highlight of these is always Nick Khan's state of the media industry on the earnings call after with analysts, and I would say, you know, Nick Khan's big message in all of this, beyond the WrestleMania performance, that they threw out a lot of statistics, and you wrote a bit about this just in terms of the Peacock deal. And now that we can look at it, like it's unquestionably been an extremely beneficial relationship. I would say for both sides, but with WWE, the just amount of people that are seeing these events are at an all time high. And it's kind of hard because they're not drilling down specific numbers, but more the year to year comparisons. And it seems that, you know, the accessibility to their biggest shows is as widespread as it's ever been.
Yeah. And just to fact check myself in real time here. Yeah. Q1 2019, 90 events. This Q1, 52 events. So that's nearly double. Q1 2018, 99 events. And that, none of that includes the NXT events either. So you're definitely right there. They're doing way fewer events. Peacock, though, I think this was my big takeaway, and it sort of it was a creeping belief before this that distribution, the increase in distribution of having the premium live events, don't call them pay per views, on Peacock, that's a big deal for WWE in terms of slowing down the decline in popularity that's been happening since 2017. Peacock is in, I know Comcast just reported, I think almost 30 million monthly active users now. The quarter before, something like 24 million. So think of that, and I believe that's all U.S., so think of that on the scale of a cable network, a big cable network is in about 80 million homes. So it's still a fraction, but that's quite a bit of coverage. And if you can think about how pay-per-views have been distributed in the past, there have been pay-per-views that were people were, they were charging $60 for. You really had to go out of your way to watch it. A WrestleMania would draw 1 million buys globally, maybe like 600,000, 700,000 buys in the U.S. So now that you'd have parties and everything, right? Lots of people per home were probably watching the pay-per-views. And then you escalated it up to about 1.1, maybe 1.2 at its peak million subscribers for the W Network. And I can look back in time and say, hey, look, in 2014 to 2016, the first few years of the W Network being in existence, we saw ticket sales rise. We saw merchandise sales rise. We see web search rise, which often coincides with the activity that we see in consumer metrics. And in the years following that, it declined. And now we're seeing these events on an even higher reach platform than the W Network. And we're starting to see finally, we're still in a pandemic, but we're starting to see, a few quarters now of the return to touring being underway. And we're seeing ticket sales are comparable to where they were in 2019. Merch per capita at the events is up to $12, which is higher than it's ever been. Average ticket price is pretty high. They reported $67 for an average ticket price in North America, whereas pre-pandemic that was around 50 to 60. I think in a WrestleMania quarter it got over $60. So they're charging quite a bit for tickets. Their e-commerce sales, which did really well during the pandemic, during the time of no touring, and offset a lot of the lack of venue merchandise, that was really high. But if you compare that to the e-commerce sales of pre-pandemic, what they reported in this quarter is better than the Q1s of the past. So, and I see web search in the U.S. and worldwide up a little bit year over year. So that tells me that, well, maybe all of this draining of W's popularity that we've seen from 2017 to 2021, I think that's finally stabilizing. It's really, I think it dawned on me that it's an underrated story in wrestling business analysis. We talk so much about stars and it's important to create stars, which it is. And I don't want to take anything away from that point. W needs to create stars and they have a lot of trouble doing that. But if you look at a lot of the boom periods of my lifetime, you'll see a lot, think about the 80s where yes, Hulk Hogan was a huge star, but it also coincided with the WF getting on cable and getting syndication nationwide, being distributed more than any wrestling promotion at that time had been distributed, at least in the U.S. And if you look at the 90s, well, maybe I could say, the late 90s boom, yes, it had a lot to do with stars involved, but it probably also had something to do with two major companies running head-to-head in prime time when lots of people are home and lots of people can watch TV. So, and I think what happened in the, let's call it the mid 2010s, had something to do with the network allowing people to watch pay-per-view events to a degree they had never watched them before, and they had access to the library, and they could engage in all this nostalgia. And now Peacock is helping those events become even more watched, and we're not seeing a boom period. Let's not get confused. We're seeing the end of this endless decline in popularity.
Do you think now that we're getting sort of away from like what we can call the pandemic period, of the impact that had on a lot of these big streaming giants? Like we saw how Disney Plus went through the roof and ESPN Plus grew exponentially and UFC hand in hand with that. And now it's coming out of it. Do you see that as like the pandemic accelerated the growth of these streamers and there's going to be a bit of a residual kind of come back to earth feeling, or has this just largely growing these streaming giants to where they might have hoped to have been 5 years from now, that this pandemic grew them that much more because of the unique circumstances?
I think that the pandemic accelerated a lot of behaviors. I don't know if it accelerated us by 5 years, but it maybe accelerated us by a year or two. I I mean, I'm not deeply in the know of what people thought was going to happen, generally in terms of streaming and in terms of cable subscribers. But, you know, my guess would be that I think people underestimated the degree to which older people would not cut the cord. I think we've sort of at this point where, you know, when I look back at the TV ratings, I just see P50 plus, it goes up and down, but across, say, 2016 to the present, yes, it goes up and down, but it's a straight line. In 2020, it's really high for, you know, news reasons, and it settles back down last year. But P50 plus people are just don't seem to be cutting the cord, or if they are, they're probably dabbling in streaming, but they're not getting rid of their cable subscription, and they're probably not signing up for subscription streaming as much. What we're seeing too is a lot of people, it's not as if every home that's not having a cable subscription is subscribing to every streaming service under the sun. They're picking and choosing. They're maybe subscribing to a few at a time and canceling this one that month and trading them in and out. And that's a lot of flexibility. And I'm not a traditional cable subscriber, but people who are listening who are, I'm sure know, it's very difficult to cancel your cable. And the customer service is, they put a lot of friction between you and cancellation. So it's just a lot of flexibility that doesn't exist in a traditional situation.
The Dana White theory that he was on the Pivot podcast this week, and his idea is that
was he?
Yes, he describes that
today, the one that came out today, because I listened to it this morning.
the Dana White one, it was a couple of days ago. This okay. was the one where the big headline was him saying the boxers are overpaid, and that's what everyone.
Who are the hosts of this podcast?
Oh, it's three former NFL players.
Okay, we're talking about a different podcast. Okay, anyway.
Okay, a different Pivot podcast? Okay, yeah. Well, maybe they pivot from one another. But nonetheless, he believes that back when it was like four major broadcast networks, we're going to have the same thing, only it's going to be four major streaming giants, and it will be global, that you will have four giants, and that is where things are going. And I guess like it's one theory. But it's also one that I think people are looking at is like, you know, with all of these streamers trying to have market share, that there's only going to be so many standing. And if you have like four, for lack of a better term, pillars, that is going to be, you know, the focus of so many of these sports rights and where they land. If you can have that kind of distribution that can support four.
Yeah, the common wisdom seems to be that we're going to see mergers and acquisitions now that are going to consolidate some of these streaming platforms and some of these traditional players. I don't know if I talked about it here, but on WrestleNomics, we've talked about it. I mean, look at Fox, that's not deeply involved in streaming. Yes, they have Tubi, which is a free ad-supported platform, but they haven't done a subscription service, I guess, other than Fox Nation. But they're, you know, they haven't deeply invested, and something like Peacock has invested billions of dollars in content. I think some of the traditional players and maybe Netflix are going to have to get together to make this all worth it in the end. And maybe we'll have, I don't know if it'll be globally. I don't know if that'll all make sense. Maybe eventually it'll be global because there's no reason, there's no limit in, probably in terms of, you know, using the internet to get the streaming video to everybody for it not to be global. But there's still a lot of different content that's needed all over the world and a lot of different price points all over the world. But I expect to see a lot of mergers and acquisitions across media for the next 3 years or so to come.
So Nick Khan, in kind of forecasting, stating that, you know, with the U.S. media rights for Raw and Friday Night SmackDown that are up in the fall of 2024, he said that they expect more buyers looking for live event programming than any time prior. And then he went into a mini state of the streaming industry, going through Netflix, Apple TV Plus, Amazon Prime, Disney Plus, Hulu, and all of their strategies regarding live event programming, and sort of just giving you the Cole's notes on where he believes everything is going and how they are entering live event programming and why it positions them so well. But it seems like that is the optimal type of environment for a Nick Khan to be taking these rights into the market if you have all of those as potential landing spots on top of your linear TV options, or some in the case, you know, of an ESPN Plus that is serving both.
Yeah, we're on the same page. That's the top of my list of things from the call. Just the reassurance that they're going to have many bidders interested, or at least, you know, that's the message that he wants to put out there. I mean, I'm sure there will be bidders beyond Fox and NBCU that'll be interested in the next round. I think you know, he talks about Amazon, Apple, every call, Netflix, every call, in terms of these are the emerging and very, especially in Apple and Amazon's case, and they have very deep pockets to do what they want in terms of buying content. They can kind of overpay because for Apple and Amazon, especially less so for Netflix, Apple and Amazon, you know, video content is not their main business. You know, Amazon is just trying to get more of your time and more of your engagement so they can sell you more retail. Apple is selling people iPhones and AirPods and so forth. So they can really pay, more maybe than somebody like Netflix can or NBCU can. And there's talk too from Nick about how, you know, look at Dancing with the Stars. That's being taken off of traditional ABC and being put onto streaming. So not just live sports coming to streaming, but live events, period. The Country Music Awards or something were mentioned as something that was put on streaming instead. So that's going to continue to be the case. Part of it, I think, is a pitch to those players, to Amazon, Apple, Netflix, you know, that, we should talk. We should discuss this. Which I wouldn't be surprised if they already are having some sort of preliminary discussions or something like that. I don't see Apple as a likely home for pro wrestling anytime soon, just because the Apple brand is such a high quality brand. I would be surprised if they embraced pro wrestling, especially this early in their embrace of live sports. Amazon, maybe. And we'll see, too. You know, next day, there's no talk of next day rights here. Next day rights are up at the end of this year. And it's probably not going to stay with Hulu, I believe. Could go to Netflix. Could go to Amazon. That's totally believable to me. And that's something that I think would really excite the stock market. And it would begin this relationship that could turn into live sports dealing.
I don't imagine it's a huge deal with Amazon Prime, but he did make reference to the one championship deal that was announced last week, noting that they found that deal to be interesting. Why do you think a Nikon is interested in that specifically?
Because it's live. Who did they sign with? What streaming service?
With Amazon Prime.
Because it's live sports and it's combat sports, it's nearer to what WWE does than any other sport, I guess. And it's Amazon. It just reassures and reinforces the idea that they could really be players. And, you know, and even if they don't go to any of these streaming companies, even if they stay on NBCU and stay on Fox for the next round, it's still, you know, pushes NBCU and Fox to bid more aggressively and to give W more money or more favorable partnership or better time slot, whatever it is.
And I think the obvious is that the more interest in WWE's rights, you know, with all of these different players potentially at the table, that somehow an AEW comes into the mix here of like, what is the value of this company when you're looking at its numbers and what its value is versus what its asking price is in comparison to WWE. If you are sold on the idea of professional wrestling as something that works on your service, then what other wrestling is out there is the natural question.
Yeah, and I think AEW, its popularity seems to be slowly growing too. That's something we've talked about quite a bit on WrestleNomics lately, and I know there's been talk elsewhere in the wrestling media ecosystem about that. I've been thinking lately, and I don't think I've said this anywhere yet. Like I was, you know, we just had a big episode last Sunday going over what I think AEW could be worth in terms of TV rights, maybe 3x, maybe as high as 5x, just based on the number of hours and the ratings that they're doing compared to other sports properties and compared to WWE. I think, you know, you look at Rampage and what Rampage is doing. It's a 1 hour show, not in a good time slot. I wonder, you know, if it were, you know, up to me, I would probably try to sell Rampage as a streaming product and let that be on a streaming platform. The problem with streaming is that it's important to these media companies. They want to grow this streaming platform because they're trying to catch behavior from people who are never going to subscribe to cable. But it's still really important, as it turns out, to be on traditional linear TV because that still has the biggest reach. So you leave Dynamite on a traditional network like TBS, and you're reaching a lot of people that way. And maybe it's fine to put Rampage, so your secondary shorter show or whatever duration it ends up being, to a streaming platform. And the impression that I'm getting is that these companies are kind of overpaying a little bit, or paying a little bit more for streaming, because what the content provider like AEW or WWE is not getting when they go to streaming is the big reach, because there's only, say, 20, 30 million subscribers here, as opposed to like 70, 80 million subscribers on traditional TV. So you get a little bit of money, get a little bit more money for going over there. And you probably reach more people by being on a streaming service while being on traditional TV. So I think that's a play, and sort of the more complex you can make the deal, as we found out in 2018, even the more money you can get by splitting up who you sell the rights to.
It was also interesting just to look at the breakdown of the television figures and what USA Network is averaging. And I mean, it really strikes you of just how impactful Raw is, or rather the loss of Raw would be to USA Network's average. Conversely, NXT 2.0 is performing under that. You have USA's average, as they listed, was 729,000 viewers. NXT 2.0 for this quarter, throwing out the sci-fi shows, would be 617,000. So it makes you wonder if that's just sort of, in play for all of this, of like where an NXT is thought strategically in all of these talks and what its addition is. When it comes to like the Raw and SmackDown rights, I think everyone is looking at some kind of streaming component here. Do you see it being something where it is just certain episodes per year are earmarked, or could you see something creative, whether it be a third hour of SmackDown or an hour of Raw that becomes streaming only, and trying to feed both sides of linear and digital? Could you see them going that deep into breaking up a show and sending your audience to multiple locations?
Yeah, a third hour of SmackDown.
I'm ready for it. I'm ready for 3 hours of SmackDown. I think we're getting a second hour of Rampage. Yeah. I think they're only going to ramp up.
You got to have the third hour of SmackDown so it competes against Rampage if they stay on at 10 o'clock. But that's plausible. Anyway, when Nick Khan talked to Ariel Helwani last summer, right, in August, he kind of joked, about the question of, is Raw too long? Is it three? I wish it was 8 hours, because it'd be more content to sell.
I want that guy to tell me, to recite the history of this 24/7 title week by week, and he can tell me how that title has how it goes week by week.
Like in terms of NXT, I don't know. Like, they've clearly punted on the idea that this is going to be something that's going to draw ratings. I think they kind of understood, if you kind of read the tea leaves of what Triple H just said, that, he had sort of acknowledged that ratings were down and that they've stabilized, which I guess they have. But it's, if they had any hope that NXT was going to be a strong media rights program, I don't think they would be doing what they're doing with it. But yeah, it's not doing great. But Raw and SmackDown are doing okay. SmackDown especially. There was a question on the call from Stephen Cahal of Wells Fargo. He wanted to know, I think he was nicely trying to ask, what do you say about ratings not doing that well after WrestleMania? Because there was a lot of talk about how great the WrestleMania viewership itself was. And Nick kind of talked about Q1, and he said, actually, if you look at the quarter, ratings are up. And as I tweeted this morning, if you look at the KPIs that they published yesterday, ratings are not up. Raw's down. SmackDown is flat. In the numbers that I have, SmackDown is up 1%. In the demo, they're both down. So I don't know what exactly he was getting at there. But in terms of their rank, I almost wonder why they don't just focus less on the viewership number, still publish it, sure, but I don't know why they don't publish some form of their ranking.
That sounds way more impressive to me, Brandon, against these NBA playoffs, is the fact they're beating, like, WWE and AEW. They are beating everything else on their night aside from the NBA. That is something to trumpet.
Yeah. Yeah. And he brought up that, you're referring to April, I think, 22nd, on Friday night, SmackDown actually beat the NBA and ABC. Well, there was an ESPN basketball game that was doing, like, twice the viewership of either SmackDown or the ABC NBA game. But, yeah. Other than that, okay performance, good performance from Nick Khan. The other thing about the viewership with WrestleMania, and I know this was published elsewhere a few weeks ago, that 56 million viewers in India watching WrestleMania. I'm trying to find out like what exactly that means. Is that a like-to-like comparison the way that we think about like P2 plus total viewership? I don't know. Because I've been looking because I figured, you know, cricket must do huge numbers. So let me start Googling cricket viewership. And what I see in some articles is you see the reach, they're talking about reach, and then sometimes they're talking about like the average viewership. And the average viewership would be what we're familiar with, SmackDown doing something like 2 million viewers. So 56 million viewers in India, if that's an average of how many people watched the entire, I guess, two telecasts, or unless that's just like the reach number of people who watched a part of the telecast, I'm not sure. But 56 million viewers. I know India is a huge country in terms of population, 1.38 billion people. That's like 4% of the population, though. That would be the equivalent, because I just did this math before I came out with you, that would be the equivalent of WrestleMania was on television traditionally in the U.S., that would be like 13 million viewers watching, you know, a W telecast, which is like on the level of only the NFL and like some college football stuff does viewership that's that high. So trying to find out if that's the number that it seems to be, which would be, you know, I think we would have to go to Ricky Dozan and the Destroyer, people watching through the shop windows to find a number that's that big.
Yes. Well, this also, they are really running hard with the 156,000 people at WrestleMania figure. So, I mean,
oh yeah, they love that number, right?
They cannot be upset if people do not give the benefit of the doubt for. So I would love to see some of the accounting for some of these figures, but
we'll see it. So next quarter, we'll probably see if history continues to be the case, we'll see the average attendance with WrestleMania, the average attendance without WrestleMania. We'll do the math and we'll figure out within a range what the paid attendance must have been, because that's what they're publishing in those KPIs for average attendance. That's paid attendance.
1 year from now, the first quarter report for 2023, do you expect that by this time next year, they will have their deals in place for Raw and SmackDown, which would be roughly the time the last deals were announced in the spring of 2018. Do you see this being about a year from now? Do you expect deals, or do you think this could go just later into the life of the contract?
I think it was after the Q1. It must have been. I have the sense that it was after the Q1 call in 2018. I would have to look. I want to say that there was a short period of time, right, where it was reported that they sold Raw to NBCU and they're putting SmackDown on the open market. And then I think a couple weeks later, they announced the SmackDown Fox deal. That might have even been June. I'm not sure. But I would guess a little bit after Q1. But that usually is when it is. And that's even when it was, I believe, in 2014, around, you know, May, June timeframe.
End of June 2018, they put out their press release for Raw and Fox Sports getting SmackDown. So a bit later. That seems later than I recall it being. But June 26, 2018 is when they put out a press release.
But that was after everything was finalized. And NBC was done first. And I'm pretty sure that was in May.
So there you go. That is the next year ahead. Brandon, do you identify yourself as a gamer?
No. I've been asking around to what a role-playing game is. I haven't got any solid answers yet, though.
Yes, you and I guess, are part of the 20% that do not identify as gamers that follow WWE programming. But that was Stephanie McMahon's part. Paul Levesque absent from this call, and I guess only notable when the Performance Center question came up about their strategy for expanding performance centers, and Frank Riddick took that one. And
I thought that was telling.
Yeah, I thought that it was as well. The fact that that was Paul Levesque's subject matter, and it did not sound like expanding performance centers was something that they are all that keen on in the future. Yeah. Like it's a very interesting development process that they have. Like they're very much touting the NIL program, but as you mentioned, like I don't see any move towards more touring for your talent. It seems to be that we're going to have this very quick in and out system where we're going to assess talent on a very quick basis. You either have it or you don't, and we're going to rush you to TV, and we're going to, you know, if we have 100 people come through the doors and we get 3 people that make it, great. That's fun.
30-day rolling contracts. I thought it was telling that, and I may be reading too deeply into this, but I thought it was telling that there's a question from an analyst about performance centers, whether you're still thinking about building them or something to that effect. And there were two questions in part of in part of what the analyst was saying. And Nick took the one question and he said, for the other question, I'm going to let Frank take care of it. And Frank Riddick is the CFO, the chief financial officer, which t- tells me that, you know, if it's the case that we're not doing that anymore, but it's just not, we're not ready to say that publicly, you know, I'm gonna you know, shove this off to the financial guy who may have to say, you know, well, we decided maybe it's not cost effective, it's not a great idea financially to do. But yeah, it's definitely not something. Why, if you're doing an NIL program and you're focusing a lot on college athletes, why do you need performance centers all over the world? It's, you know, I don't think this vision of talent development would ever build a UK performance center at this point. In the UK, NXT seems so de-emphasized at this point.
Before we wrap things up, I also wanted to just touch upon today was the official public on sale for AEW and New Japan's Forbidden Door show that's happening at the United Center, June the 26th. They had the pre-sale on Thursday, and tickets were gone of the available allotment within 40 minutes. And I haven't seen the latest updates, but it looks like, you know, there were only a few thousand tickets left. This has been an unmitigated success for the show. Was this kind of the demand you sensed for this show? Was this at all a surprise for this concept? No matches announced, selling out the United Center immediately.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I guess it did a little bit better than I was expecting. I mean, I imagine that it would, I guess, sell out eventually. I don't know that I was confident it would sell out as fast as it did, though. Mm-hmm. It is just, I guess, mainly, you know, how many times are you going to run Chicago? But they sold it out anyway. So there you go. It's been one of the things I've been noticing about AEW is that they've been running a lot of the same markets again and again. I mean, Chicago, obviously, but a lot of the same markets again and again. They still haven't been to Canada. They're finally going to California soon. But yeah, they're doing really well for that. It's not clear to me, you know, is this who's taking home the money for this? You know, is it New Japan and AEW truly running this in a partnership, or is it, you know, is New Japan just sort of being paid for it, or what the deal is?
Yeah, it is an interesting question of how you would break that down, because we do have the comparable of New Japan running shows featuring AEW talent, and they're trying to fill 2,000 seat buildings. And, you know, this, while it's being promoted as like a co-promoted event, this does feel like this is an AEW show with New Japan talent attached to it. And the difference of, you know, 12,000 people is going to be
the pay-per-view will be the biggest part. You know,
sure.
This maybe it draws like $1 million gate. I guess I don't know what the ticket prices have been like, and it's certainly big enough to, if the average ticket is high enough to draw $1 million at the gate. But if they sell, you know, 100,000 buys, that's multiple times more money than they'll draw at the gate.
So that is going to wrap up our look at the quarter. In terms of Q2, Brandon, that will be the WrestleMania quarter, and they didn't give too much guidance on what they're expecting. They're projecting adjusted OIBDA of $80 to $90 million for the quarter, but so much of this will be contingent on WrestleMania. No Saudi Arabia show this quarter, although they said to look out for another Saudi show later this year, which
it's just the one in October that they clearly have a space for, but they just haven't. They're not ready. Who knows what political turmoil could happen between now and then? You know.
Yes. The other section was well represented for Q1 with a nice hefty $60.5 million in recognized revenue.
All their non-Saudi event quarters, it's like 10 million, maybe five.
Yeah. They are softening a little. They are saying the country more often now. We still get large scale live event multiple times, but they're slowly integrating the actual name.
Yes,
as
we get further and further from the last time there's been a major international news story surrounding the Saudi government, it gets a little bit safer to say Saudi Arabia.
Yes, it's always an interesting tap dance that they go through through all of these and their means to secure international funding. But that is going to wrap things up. Brandon has a great rundown talking about the distribution model of what WWE and historically what has coincided with major peaks for the company's popularity up at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. And I am sure you're going to be diving more so into the quarterly report with Chris Gullo this Sunday night. And I will say that the artwork for WrestleNomics, I mean, you are just topping yourself, Brandon. I thought last week with WCW and the AOL Time Warner merger in the rearview window. I mean, yeah. Just beautiful.
Let's say it's an image. There's an image from a Marshall McLuhan book. Are you familiar with Marshall McLuhan?
The medium is
Canadian.
The message. Yes.
Yes. Yes. That's very much on theme with what the article that I just put up on Patreon is about. You know, sort of we're not paying enough attention to, we're paying very much attention to the content and what's on the screen, which we should. I don't know if he would agree with that, but we're paying attention to, you know, is Roman Reigns over? How big of a star is he? Who else are they developing? And, you know, how much are these stars and these matches going to draw? But, the medium itself, the Peacock in this case is a big difference maker, I think, for WWE. So yeah, we'll see what images I come up with.
Here's the last question. Let's end with a heavy philosophical one. So we have seen the impact of WWE. We can call this the fixed revenue era. Okay. That is what they are in right now. Very hard to mess up this business model, regardless of stars. We have seen the impact too on creative at a time when profits have never been higher. Revenue has never been higher. Creative satisfaction, I would say, is not at an all-time high. Do you, as a fan out there, do you root for these gigantic rights deals for a WWE, for an AEW, where your revenue is fixed to such a high amount that you are not a slave to your creative process week by week to have the consumer confidence when so much of your revenue, it's a guaranteed home run before you even step up the bat every week?
As an unbiased, indifferent reporter, I have no opinion about this. No, I think, I mean, look at AEW. I think AEW is a good product. Like, it's creatively speaking, I think it's a far superior product to WWE. And just as much of their revenue is guaranteed. I think there's a little bit of wiggle room on their TV deal in terms of ad revenue, but I think the vast majority of it is guaranteed. And yet they still manage to put out a show that I think we would agree is pretty good most of the time. And WWE doesn't, and I don't think it's because they don't. I think the guaranteed money in Vince's case just gives him the freedom to do whatever he wants without financial consequence. So he does, and Tony's not like Vince in that way, and Tony knows a little bit more about how to appeal to a certain kind of wrestling fan who is captivated by AEW.
It is always a fascinating discussion with you, Brandon. I encourage everyone to check out WrestleDomics on Patreon and Sundays here at postwrestling.com. You can follow him at Brandon Thurston. And that is going to wrap things up for the Post Daily News Show. Again, we are live Saturday night after UFC 274, Sunday night after WrestleMania Backlash. We're not going to go through all of Brandon's picks for WrestleMania Backlash. Are you going to watch any of the Miami Grand Prix, Brandon, on Sunday afternoon?
Is that on ESPN?
Yes,
I don't get ESPN as part of my sling package, so no.
A big race. I believe Dwayne Johnson will be attending this race. Really? They're saying that this is really broken into the U.S. market.
Is this the only one that's in the U.S., or are there more?
I think this is the only one, but don't quote me on that. I know they have a big one. They're going to Las Vegas next year.
That they're all over the world, because when I did that ratings analysis, I saw that, you know, it was like Grand Prix in all these different countries. So, yes, I'm aware.
It's a wild, very global time. Yes. So Formula One, their rights are up this year. So everyone can pay attention to that as well. So yeah. That will wrap things up for us, everybody. We'll chat with you on Saturday night after UFC 274. That is all. Thank you for tuning in to the Post Daily News Show.